All right, well, we're going to go forward because I don't know when this person might connect, but so we're hoping this issue with the timing doesn't repeat, and it seems to have been resolved. If it does, we will communicate with you as soon as we can. All right, Marshall, could you please call us to order?
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Eade, Judge Harris, Judge John Smith, the Honorable Kayala Eade presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Today is March 6, 2025. We have three cases on our Zoom oral argument calendar this morning. My name is Kayla Eade. I'm serving as presiding judge. I'm joined by Judge Harris and Judge Smith. The first case on our Zoom oral argument calendar is A241914 in the matter of the civil commitment of Dina, I hope I pronounced that right, Joy Alexander. And before we proceed, just a couple of housekeeping matters. There is a recording of this proceeding that's being made. It'll be available on our website, usually later today or tomorrow. That's the only recording that is to be made of these proceedings. If you no other screen recording is allowed, and a failure to abide by that rule could result in court sanction. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 15 minutes for your initial argument. And 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes for your argument. When you begin your argument, please state your name and the party who you're representing. And with that, Mr. Reisdorfer, you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Chris Reisdorfer, and I represent the appellant, Dina Alexander. Ms. Alexander brings up two issues on appeal in regards to her commitment hearing that occurred in this case. First is that there was a lack of due, she suffered a lack of due process by the court not following the procedures contained in the Minnesota Commitment and Treatment Act. As contained in the brief, there were, I believe, three primary irregularities that occurred in this case, which deprived her of her right to due process through the proceedings. Additionally, Ms. Alexander is asserting that the county did not satisfy its burden by clear and convincing evidence that she was a mentally ill individual that it would pose a substantial risk of danger to herself or others. In regards to the first argument, again, in regards to this case, there were multiple irregularities that occurred, which would we submit deprived her of her right to due process. As a commitment infringes on a person's liberty, there must be a due process of law. As noted in the brief, we would submit that the biggest lack of due process was Ms. Alexander's right to pick the examiner of her choice. And there was obviously, I believe, looking at the record, some confusion in regards to what who Miss Alexander wanted to have as her second examiner. Originally, she had requested Dr. Linda Marshall, given she had experience with her previously. And then the court, after a letter was submitted by her attorney, had interpreted that Miss Alexander no longer wanted Miss Dr. Marshall as that second examiner. However, while it is potentially understandable that the letter submitted by her attorney was a request to have a new court examiner appointed, nothing in that letter is specifically asks for a different examiner to be appointed.
Also, as it relates to the due process issue, what's the prejudice here? It seems to me that everyone agrees, or at least let's presume everyone agrees, that there is some confusion about Ms. Alexander's kind of wishes, and that her lawyer did send a letter saying that she was unhappy with the examiner, the court. Then appointed another examiner. What's the prejudice here?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would submit that the prejudice here is that Miss Alexander was, I believe, cognizant of that she needed mental health services, but she wanted an examiner of her choosing in regards to the recommendations for her treatment plan. She was familiar with Miss Dr. Marshall, had prior experiences with her, and the prejudice I would submit is that she wanted this relationship with Dr. Marshall to get the best services for her to address her mental health. And that'd be what,
Is there anything in the record that would indicate that the examiner that your client wanted would have made a different recommendation than the examiner that actually provided an opinion.
In my reading of the record, no, Your Honor. There is nothing I could point to the record that states Dr. Marshall would have made a different finding. However, I believe that is there's nothing in the record because we don't know what Dr. Marshall would have recommended. Without her report, we wouldn't be able to her testimony. There's nothing to say she would or wouldn't have had something, and I can understand that that may be speculative about, well, is there prejudice or not, but would submit that this is a right that is granted under the statute to Miss Alexander, that she gets a right to pick the examiner of her choosing. She wanted Dr. Marshall, and by not having Dr. Marshall, that is violating her due process rights. In regards, notwithstanding the request to have Dr. Marshall as her examiner, again, the court, I believe, district court would have been within its right to remedy the situation by reappointing Dr. Marshall. And as noted in the brief, it is, I believe, a discretionary standard for a court to appoint a third examiner. A case, I believe, in Williams, that is the primary case that I believe talks about appointing a third examiner, and it does say it's I believe, an abuse of discretion standard. And I would submit in this situation, given there still was time to have Miss Dr. Marshall appointed to conduct the examination. Again, the 30-day timeline, while it was upcoming from the original filing of September 17th, there still was time to have Dr. Marshall appointed. She was willing to do that based off of the affidavit of Miss Alexander's trial counsel. And by the court not, I believe, appointing it, Dr. Marshall, if it's to be construed as a third examiner, would be an abuse of discretion under these circumstances. Again,
You agree that, so this is framing the issue slightly differently, right? You're arguing that even if, Dr. Marshall should not have been a, or should have been a, even if it was okay that the district court didn't appoint Dr. Marshall as the second examiner, do you agree that you would still need to show prejudice as to the, even if we agree with you that the district court might have abused its discretion by not appointing Dr. Marshall as a third examiner, do you still need to show prejudice as to that decision?
I believe so, Your Honor, under the current case law, yes.
And so then I guess the same question is there something different other than what you said? It sounds like you somewhat conceded that it's a bit speculative, given the state of the record, to presume that there would have been any sort of different opinion. And these, I mean, I'm not, I don't mean to diminish the rights at all under the statute, but what can we point to support the analysis you're asking us to adopt to say that your client was prejudiced, even if we frame this as a third examiner error?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that where the prejudice comes from is, again, as contained in the brief, is that, well, I don't believe that one single of these incidents would be prejudicial. I'd say looking at all of them that together is that there was enough irregularities with this process that Miss Alexander did not ha her due process rights were violated without having the examiner of her choosing. Again, if it's again, well, it is framed alternatively of either she should have had Dr. Marshall, she made that request as a second examiner, or the court could have appointed her as Dr. Marshall as a third examiner. Again, that I believe was against her rights under the statute. And again, as also contained in the brief, she didn't have enough time to speak to her attorney, as well as the Dr. Yerkes report not being submitted within 48 hours. And I would submit that looking at all these irregularities, there needs to be some mechanism in order to enforce Miss Alexander's rights here is that there was these irregularities that she didn't have all the rights upheld at the district court level. And while it is this obviously our burden to show, I believe that there is prejudice to her. I would submit that when you don't have the examiner of your choosing, you don't get the examiner's report within 48 hours, you're not having enough time to talk to your attorney. Is that there's with all those irregularities that Miss Alexander did not have a fair t opportunity to defend against this commitment petition.
48 hours with the report. What's your response to your counterpart's argument that this is invited error because The offer of a continuance by the district court was declined, and so the objection to proceeding was just noted on the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did notice that in respondent's brief is that there was this objection made, and the trial counsel did not take the continuance with this matter, Your Honor. And I would submit that just look it, again, the objection was noted. And looking at the circumstances here, it appears that the court did not have an interest in continuing this matter any further. Is that when you look at the request for have Dr. Marshall appointed, which was denied. Again, well, and then, well,
But
the there was.
is that a fair reading of the record? I mean, the district court specifically on page 6 of the transcript says, I would agree to continue this. If that is not something you want to do, Mr. Kramer, then I'll proceed. Would you like a continuance of this hearing? Response by counsel was no, Your Honor. So how are we to read that as the district court isn't interested in granting a continuance?
Well, I appreciate that, Your Honor, is that, well, yes, the transcript does say that, but I would also submit that when there was a request to have a third examiner or have Dr. Marshall be reappointed, that request was denied. And I believe inherent in that was that the court was doing that because they didn't want to continue these matters any further. Again, while that is clear, the transcript says that is that, I would grant a continuance and for
I'm just
that.
trying to keep the issues distinct because the third examiner, I mean, with your cumulative error argument, right, you've added to it the violation of the 48-hour report rule. And it looks like the opportunity to continue was offered and was declined. And so is there a specific response to the invited error argument just on that issue that you'd like us to be aware of?
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I don't have a specific response to that, but again, I would submit that looking at again all of the cumulative issues there that Miss Alexander's, even with if considering an invited error, without being able to have the examiner of her choosing and the time to speak to her attorney, Miss Alexander's rights, due process rights were violated. I'd like to also address the second argument that Miss Alexander is bringing is in regards to that the county did not meet its burden by clear and convincing evidence that Miss Alexander was a danger to herself or others. Again, as the court is aware, this is a clear and convincing standard that the dis that must be shown by the county that Miss Alexander has a mental illness and is a either a danger a substantial risk to herself or others. And I would submit that looking at the record, Miss Alexander had admitted that she has a mental illness and would like to get some services for her. But looking at the record, I do not believe there's enough there to show that she was a substantial risk of likelihood of physical harm to herself. And looking at the case again, there was Dr. Yerka. His report had indicated that she was not, while she, obviously was being confined, which would limit the risk of her being a danger to herself or others, she had been compliant while she was in custody. And but Dr. Yerka's report noted that she had concerns that she may be evicted. And I would submit that, that's more of a future speculative about she would be homeless, but wasn't, I believe, a concrete certainty of that she couldn't make her basic needs given a futuristic possible eviction. And while there is, as contained in respondent's brief, that there was some reference contained in the Rule 20 report of a domestic assault incident or alleged domestic assault incident as it again had been charged and not proven, that was again I believe there was vague statements to that effect, and that there wasn't any concrete evidence that related to alleged threats. A case that kind of similarly pointed on this, was in matter of civil commitment, Emberlin, where the court had found that there was not the burden had not been satisfied that the individual posed a substantial likelihood of physical harm to self or others. And I would submit that similarly here is that while Miss Alexander had a mental illness and may have been an argumentative that there was not a There's not clear and convincing evidence that she would pose a substantial risk. Again, not just a slight risk, but that she was a, had a substantial likelihood of being a danger to herself or others when taking a look at what the record was before the court.
Does that require us to reweigh the evidence in order to agree with you?
I don't believe it would be required to reweigh the evidence. My understanding is that it's a de novo standard that the court would look at of in regards to the evidence that's what the standard before the court is. It can't, I don't believe it reweigh the evidence, but looking at there with what evidence was presented, that I don't believe that shows there was enough evidence there for the court to make a finding that it was clear and convincing evidence of a substantial risk of bodily harm. In conclusion, Ms. Alexander is requesting that that the court reverse the district court's ruling of commitment in this matter. Again, they'll be submitting that there was too much irregularity with the district court proceedings, which violated her due process rights, and that the burden had not been met by clear and convincing evidence that there was that she posed a substantial likelihood of harm to herself or others. If there are not any further questions by the court, I would yield the rest of my time.
Counsel, Mr. Smith, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent respondent Southwest Health and Human Services in this appeal. This court should affirm the order committing appellant as mentally ill for four reasons. First, appellant waived her due process claim when she failed to raise it below. Second, the district court complied with the Minnesota Commitment and Treatment Act's procedures. Third, even if the district court did err as appellant claims, appellant has failed to show that any alleged error prejudiced her. Instead, she simply asked this court to presume that she was prejudiced. Finally, the record contains sufficient evidence, particularly the reports of both examiners as well as the second examiner's testimony, to support the district court's finding that appellant posed a substantial risk of physical harm to herself or others. And starting with that last point first, Judge Ide, as you noted, appellant's argument does invite this court to reweigh the evidence. And this court is reviewing the district court's finding of fact that appellant posed a substantial likelihood of physical harm to herself or others for clear error. And that finding of fact here is amply supported by the record. You had evidence from both examiners that the appellant was unable to meet her basic needs. Dr. Yerka testified that the appellant had no insight really into her, no meaningful insight into her mental health condition, that she had a history of being unwilling to address her mental health condition voluntarily, especially through taking a medication. Dr. Yerka's opinion was based in part on speaking to appellant's son, who said that it was his understanding that appellant hadn't taken medication for her mental health condition in years. Both doctors opined that the appellant's mental illness caused disturbed thoughts. The first examiner specifically referenced those disturbed thoughts giving rise to criminal conduct, including a domestic assault against the son. And there's also the evidence that the appellant's living conditions were extremely filthy and cluttered. All of these things taken together provide some record support for the district court's finding that appellant posed a substantial likelihood of physical harm to herself or others. And adopting appellant's position would require this court to reweigh the evidence and substitute its judgment for the district court's judgment, something that the Supreme Court has made clear, especially in commitment proceedings. And I would point to In re Kenney for that proposition, that that's not what we do on clear error. We don't reweigh findings. We don't reweigh the evidence to see if an appellate court would decide things differently.
Did the district court do enough to explain and connect specific facts from the examiner's report to its conclusion? I am a little concerned that some of the statements in the district court's order are just adoptions, direct adoptions of the examiner's opinion, and I know you're aware of Spicer and the requirements there. So, Can you address that?
I think it did because the district court, first of all, does point beyond the simple, conclusory statement, the recitation of the statutory language, and does point to particular failures, the failure to address medical issues, the evidence of a recent threat of or attempt to harm someone else, particularly the son. Although the district court doesn't point to that specific fact, when you couple the district court's order and written findings with a clear record, it's not like there was a whole lot of contest about the underlying facts here. I think that is sufficient. Could it be better? Certainly, it could be better. But the clear error standard of review doesn't require perfection, certainly. It just requires that there be some record support for the finding that the district court made. And I think that's satisfied here. If I was writing it, would I write it differently? Certainly. But that's unfortunately not the way these things go. Turning back to the appellant's due process claims, that claim fails on its own for two reasons. First, as I stated in my introductory remarks, appellant waived her due process claim by failing to first raise it in the district court. Nowhere in the record below was there any indication that the appellant was raising a due process claim, and appellant hasn't made any argument in response to
Here, Mr.
respond.
Smith, I'm going to pause you. Can we pause, Marshall, at 9:52 the clock? Thank you. So I'm sure everyone just saw the pop-up. Apparently, our issue is not resolved. If we are kicked off here, and I'm eating into your nine minutes and 30 seconds left in our Zoom, we'll have to log back in, apparently, we'll keep working on a resolution to this. I apologize. Go ahead. And we can restart.
Your Honor, to facilitate the technical issue, I would be w happy to simply say, I would rest on my brief unless the court has other questions for me about the issues raised, and then cede my time back, and we can move on to rebuttal.
Judge Harris, did you have a question?
No, I don't have any questions.
Judge Smith?
I'm fine.
Yeah, I do have a quick question before we move to rebuttal. I do have a little bit of a concern. I mean, the not allowing the attorney to speak to the client mid-hearing was a little troubling to me. I guess there's two issues. Like, how does one show prejudice in this situation, for both the issue of the examiner, in your view? These are court-appointed examiners. Was it incumbent upon the appellant to retain her own examiner and say, offer a proof based on this, that there would have been a different treatment plan or a different recommendation altogether? And then did there need to be a fully developed offer proof of what she would have testified to had she been given that opportunity to speak to her attorney? It does trouble me that it went down the way it did without allowing her to speak to her lawyer. So if you could address that quickly.
Certainly, Your Honor. First, with regard to the denying the appellant an opportunity to speak to her lawyer sort of mid-hearing, I think it's important to remember that this doesn't arise in a vacuum. It arises in a particular context. That's a context where the appellant had voluntarily absented herself from the hearing and refused to participate. The district court could have continued the hearing without even giving appellant a further opportunity to be involved in the proceedings because she had voluntarily absented herself. Given that context and the fact that the appellant continued to be disruptive and that the hearing had been ongoing, I think it was reasonable for the district court to say, I'm not gonna put this hearing on pause indefinitely to allow you to talk to your attorney. You've had time to talk to your attorney amply before the hearing, which the district court made a record of and made findings about after inquiring with appellant's trial counsel. And it graciously offered the appellant an opportunity to return after she had disrupted the proceedings by calling the district court judge a criminal, threatening prison, and then making a profane, obscene gesture as she left the room where she in the jail where she was appearing from. But given all of those facts, the district court didn't abuse its discretion here. And I think it's important to remember that the right here is a statutory right to counsel. It's not a constitutional right to counsel. And that statutory right to counsel, as it's specified in the Commitment and Treatment Act, only specifically addresses consultation prior to the hearing. It doesn't guarantee a right to consultation during the hearing. Could the district court have allowed the consultation? Yes. In light of what had transpired in this particular hearing, was it reasonable to not do so? I think so. With regard to what is required as far as a showing of prejudice, I would submit that first, something before beyond the mere fact of an alleged violation of a statutory right is at least necessary to show prejudice. And I, certainly an offer of proof would go a long ways towards showing prejudice. The prejudice test in the civil context is talks about, did the error affect the substantial rights? Given the closeness of the recommendations and the conclusions between the first examiner and the second examiner, on the record here, I don't think it's reasonable to conclude that a third examiner might have come to a different conclusion absent some offer of proof. So I think you have to do something. I don't know if it's a full-blown retain your own expert. But at the very least, taking the court up on its offer of a continuance and then trying to address things would have gone some distance. Here, there's just no allegation of prejudice other than my rights were violated. But that's just error. And given that, I don't think it's necessary to figure out here exactly what would be required to show prejudice in this context. I would simply ask this court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Reisdorfer, there's 4 minutes and 25 seconds left in the Zoom. If you need additional time at the end of your argument, let us know.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I'll be very quick here. The main thing I'd like to point out on rebuttal is that, in regards to the claim that Ms. Alexander had forfeited or did not bring up this matter in the district court and therefore waived it, I would respectfully disagree. Is that while there was nothing in the record that specifically mentions due process, I would note that there were objections made to preserve these issues. Again, it was noted that she objected to, Dr. Your His report that she did not have the examiner of her choosing. And taking all of that, I would submit that she had pres those issues were preserved for the court to consider the matter before it. And additionally, even if the court does find that these the due process arguments were waived, I would respectfully request under Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 103.04 that the court can review this matter as the interests of justice may require. And I would submit that the interest of justice does require this as. And at least in my review of the case law and preparing the brief, is that most of the appellate case law does not appear to real is not primarily focused on mental illness or chemical dependency civil commitments. They tend to be on cases where you have mentally ill and dangerous individuals or sexually dangerous individuals. And I would submit that this case, the court looking at these issues, reviewing the matter would be helpful in developing the body of case law, as there isn't, I believe, an actual issue here, but would be helpful to clarify the law in regards to these type of civil commitments, which don't, I believe, come up on appeal or appeals that seems that often, given the, quick, these types of civil commitments tend to be shorter in duration, 6 months to a year, and submit that the court should address these due process arguments in the interest of justice. If there aren't any other questions, given our time constraint, I respectfully yield my time. Thank you.
I just want to be clear. Wait, Judge Harris, do you have any questions?
I do not.
Judge
I do
Smith?
not even.
And I don't want you to feel constrained by time, Mr. Reisdorfer. If you need more time, we will make time for you. So just let us know now.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. And I rely on my brief, and I do appreciate the court's allowing that an additional extension needed, but I'm all right today. Thank you.
All right. Thank you both for your helpful arguments today. The matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion in the statutory timeframe. For those of you who are here for our next argument, just to sum up again, we're having an issue where the Zoom is limited to 40 minutes for some reason. So we're going to have to log off and log back in to restart the Zoom. and I apologize that this issue seems to be recurring. So that concludes our first oral argument, and I would ask everyone that's here for the second argument or any members of the public to log off and rejoin. Thank you.